I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Earlier this year, Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum called President Obama a snob because he was promoting college for all, which Santorum called indoctrination mills. While Santorum was criticized for those comments, colleges and universities have had their share of other critics who question the value of higher education. Students graduating with thousands of dollars of debt and uncertain job prospects only add to the urgency of this issue. Our guest, Andrew Delbanco, is the author of a new and timely book titled College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. He asks a very simple question in his book, what is college for? The answer is not so simple and raises a whole host of other questions. Andrew Delbanco is the Mendelson Family Chair of American Studies and the Julian Clarence Levi Professor of Humanities at Columbia University. He joins us from the NPR Bureau in New York. And Andrew Delbanco, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Harvard College, the oldest college in the country, and maybe that's why I wrote a book that goes back to the beginning.
Did you get a good college education?
Could have been a lot better. I think I began to realize after college all the things I had missed. It wasn't an institution that gave us too much guidance on what we should study. But I had a very good experience through acquaintances with my fellow students. And I think one of the fundamental points about the American college is that we really have believed in this country for a long time that students have a great deal to learn from each other, which is quite a distinctive educational idea, actually, if you look at the larger world.
Well, even looking at some of this history, and perhaps even looking at the history of Harvard, is that early on in this country, college was about, as you write, character development. How so?
Well, the early colleges, of which we still have, you know, some of the most prestigious, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and so on, really began as institutions closely allied to church denominations. And they were unembarrassed and frank about the fact that they were training Christian gentlemen, but not for lives of idle self-indulgence, for lives of public service, ministers, school teachers, people who believed that having privilege meant that you owed the society something and needed to give back.
Noblesse oblige?
I think in a way you could call it the American version of noblesse oblige, and I think it's been one of our grandest traditions, that generation that sometimes gets called the greatest generation. I'm always leery of generalizations about this or that group of people, but it is true that 50, 60 years ago, when our most selective colleges were not as hard to get into as they are today, they seemed to produce people with a sense of public-spiritedness, and I worry whether we're doing that anymore.
But do you think today's colleges, universities should be more concerned with this idea of character?
I think they should. I mean, you know, I'm not interested in going back to an age of indoctrination in which faculty or presidents inculcate their own point of view in their students. That's never been easy because students are always skeptical about what older people tell them. But some of the implied values that seem to attach to college education today, particularly elite selective colleges, make me uncomfortable. I mean, one way to think about this, you mentioned Senator Santorum, former Senator Santorum at the opening. He made this comment about colleges producing snobs and people who were self-satisfied, and I thought it was unfair. I thought he misconstrued what President Obama said. But I thought there was a grain of truth in what he said. It's my experience that when the new students arrive at a highly selective college, you can almost bet for sure that the president and the dean will say, you are the best and the brightest ever. You're just fabulous. I wouldn't have had a chance to get in myself. You've accomplished so much. You overcame all this stiff competition to get here, and it's just terrific to have you here. You're God's gift to the world. Of course, students who get to selective colleges have worked hard, and many of them deserve recognition. But at the same time, this mad arms race that we're in, by which these places will turn away 20,000, 25,000 other very worthy applicants, I think the better message is, you know, you've enjoyed a lot of advantages. You're here for a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with you. And you ought to recognize that, and you ought not to imagine that the folks who didn't get in here are somehow inferior to you. That's a message that I think colleges should send out a little more clearly these days.
In fact, you challenge this notion or this belief about meritocracy, the idea that if you work hard and you're talented, you will get accepted at places like Harvard. But what you say is that when you look at many of the students, they come from wealthy families. They've had all the advantages in the world. They've had the SAT prep scores. They've been able to travel the world and experience a kind of life that a regular middle class or striving, struggling, you know, upper lower class person really hasn't had.
Well, I'm afraid that's true. And, you know, again, I'm very reluctant to say things to suggest that I don't admire and value many of my students at Columbia. We have wonderful students. Many of them are going to go out and do what they can to make the world a better place. But these institutions are locked in a prestige race with each other. And one of the factors in that race is, you know, how high are the SAT scores of the students we take? Now, the fact of the matter is that SAT score, the only thing it really correlates closely with is family income. Hmm. If you see very high SAT scores, you can be almost certain that those students come from upper middle class or higher families. They have many advantages that enable them to achieve those high scores. And the scores say very, very little about individuals. They certainly don't say anything. They don't measure in any way qualities like selflessness, responsibility, integrity. So this obsession we have with test scores is not a healthy thing.
But I think also when you look at those resumes, and I've seen some of them, you also have students who have written poetry and have, you know, gone to Appalachia and can speak five languages. I mean, these are talented young people.
Right. Well, sure they are. But we've gotten into a situation now where from the third grade on or even earlier in some places, life seems to be all about establishing the credentials to get into one of these colleges, which is crazy on lots of levels because there are hundreds of very fine institutions of higher education in this country. And our obsession with the elites is an unhealthy one.
Let me quote something from your book. You write, in short, over roughly the first two-thirds of the 20th century, there persisted at elite colleges a strong current of social snobbery, as well as an undercurrent of anti-intellectualism, not to mention outright racism and anti-Semitism. Strong words there. Do you think these elite universities have moved beyond that?
Well, sure. I mean, look, I'm telling a complicated story, yes. I think, which is always a challenge. There are many things about these institutions that are much better than they used to be. It used to be thought that women were too fragile for serious intellectual work, and there were some colleges exclusively for women, but it took a long time for the major private institutions to open their doors to women. Frank anti-Semitism was there for a very long time. It's quite remarkable to go back and look at the correspondence between presidents and admissions officers and prep school headmasters trying to figure out whether such and such a candidate is actually Jewish or not. Mm. And African Americans, of course, had very little opportunity to attend these institutions until very recently. All of that has changed, and that's terrific. I'm all for diversity. I actually think that diversity, though I think it means many things beyond what we usually mean by it, diversity is actually a very old idea, I think, in the history of the American college. If you go all the way back to the Puritan origins, you find those ministers saying, you know, what we're looking for when we consider whether to admit you to our church is your capacity to edify another. Hmm. That is, what will you, it's sort of a 17th century version of today's admissions officer's question, what will you bring to this class? Why will your presence make this a better mix and make the experience of your fellows a better one? And I think that's a good question, and I think it pushes us in all kinds of directions. So there's much to celebrate about the American college. There's much to be worried about as well, and I think, if I may say so, we ought to also talk about institutions beyond the elite selectives,
sure,
because ultimately they're even more important for the future of our country.
Fair enough. Let me just touch on another piece of history that you write about. So looking at maybe 100 years ago or so, the development of the professions where doctors and lawyers and others would go to college or a graduate school in order to be able to get the kind of skills to be a professional. Why is that significant? What's the significance of that?
Well, you know, in my book, I try to make a distinction that I think we don't often register in our minds, and that is the difference between a university and a college. Universities didn't really exist until a little more than 100 years ago. And universities are great institutions, which we should be very proud of and have made huge contributions to our society, but they're fundamentally research institutions and places for training people in specialties, including the professions that you've just mentioned. Mm-hmm. In some ways, the values of the university run counter to those of the college, and that tension is very palpable at colleges like mine, where there's a college that's inside a big research university, but it's evident at all colleges because most college faculty have been trained in universities and have acquired the values of the university. What I mean by that is that one of the distinctive features of American colleges is that we have always believed that young people negotiating that treacherous territory between adolescence and adulthood, age 18, 19, 17, whatever, deserve some space for self-discovery. They deserve the opportunity to fail at some things, to explore subjects that they might not have even been aware of before, to discover talents and passions that they didn't know they had. And what worries me is that this pressure for early specialization, early determination of who you are and what you want and what you're good at, is getting stronger and stronger, so that that rehearsal space, as it were, self-discovery space that used to be associated with college is shrinking and getting narrower. And I worry about that. I think every institution has to figure out the right balance here. And of course, especially in this very tough economy, it's perfectly reasonable for parents and their children to wonder and worry about what they're going to do after college. But if we get to the point where we just obliterate that opportunity for experimentation, I think that would be a great loss for our society.
And we're almost up on a break here, but just to underscore what you said, and I think there is such enormous pressure and anxiety about what happens after college that can sometimes derail the time spent, as you described, for failure and self-discovery.
It can, and what's remarkable is you feel that pressure and that distortion even at the most elite institutions, where you would think most of the graduates could be pretty confident that they'll do okay.
And that's Andrew DelBanco, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's titled Simply Enough, College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. He is the Mendelsohn Family Chair of American Studies and the Julian Clarence Levi Professor of Humanities at Columbia University. And he joins us on Radio Times to talk about some of the history of colleges and universities in the U.S. and also looking for answers to a very provocative question about what college is for. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing Education at PAFA offers art classes and workshops for all ages and levels this fall, including figure drawing, portrait painting, bronze casting, silk screen printing, and more. Featuring pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum, landscape on location at historic Yellow Springs Chester Springs Studio, and a masterclass with noted artist Beau Bartlett. Classes begin September 13th. For details, pafa.edu/ce.
4 years ago in Denver, Democrats nominated Barack Obama for president.
With profound gratitude and great humility, I accept your nomination for presidency of the United States.
This week, President Obama addresses the Democratic Convention in Charlotte. I'm Mara Liasson. Join us for special coverage from NPR News.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY-FM and WHYY-TV.
The Republicans made their pitch to voters during last week's convention in Tampa. Now it's the Democrats' turn as they convene in Charlotte. We'll speak with the chairman of this year's Democratic National Convention, the mayor of Los Angeles, Antonia Villaraigosa. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Andrew Del Banco about his new book called College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. One of the arguments in his book is that we need a liberal arts education because it's essential to our democracy. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You teach at Columbia University, and I know you teach a very popular course or probably a series of courses there. What, though, looking at an undergraduate at any kind of university or college, what do you think they should be studying?
Well, I'm not in the business of prescribing what people should be studying or specializing in, but I do think that as important as the practical skills are that one hopes to gain from the college education and enable one to go forward into the marketplace, one of the great secrets of the American college has been that it's a place where students learn to work together, to collaborate, in small discussion classes, whatever the topic may be, history, philosophy, ethical ideas, scientific problems. They learn to listen to one another, to speak with civility, to learn the difference between an argument and an opinion. Seems to me that those are the qualities that we need to maintain a healthy democracy. And wherever one stands on the political spectrum, I suspect there's pretty general agreement that we're not doing so great in that area. So I don't like, and I'm not saying that you posed it that way, Marty, but I don't like when this question is an either or. You know, is college about acquiring skills to get a job, or is college about self-fulfillment and the development of the finer faculties? It seems to me it's got to be both. We don't want to have physicians, for example, who are really good at organic chemistry and biology and anatomy and pathology, but who, when they walk into the hospital room, can't understand that they're dealing with a human being, who have no sensitivity to the fact that human beings come from a variety of experiences, and that may have a lot to do with how they think about their health, their future, their families. So we want humanely educated physicians. We want scientists, and I think scientists actually do better at this than people in the humanities. We want scientists who have a broad view of the condition of our planet and the way different societies use their resources and so on. So it's not an either or. I mean, we want engineers and architects who realize that, you know, human beings are going to be working and living in the buildings they put up. Colleges have an enormously important role to play and always have had in our society to maintain a humane democratic society. And we don't want to turn them into purely vocational schools, which I fear is what's happening across the board.
Well, and I agree with you. I don't want this to be an either-or conversation either, and in part because of my checkered career in education and higher education. But as you were talking, I was thinking about medical schools that have instituted literature courses for doctors because they want them to read Anna Karenina, you know, to understand what it is to be a human. We just interviewed two of the scientists affiliated with the Mars mission and the Curiosity rover. I mean, one of them was basically a college dropout who was in a rock band. The other one was an art major here in Philadelphia and got into video games. They are, you know, they are launching and very involved in this unbelievable scientific exploration.
Exactly right. I mean, creative people are not easy to pigeonhole, and they don't want to be specialists early on. They may discover something that they're particularly passionate about and pursue that in later life, but we want to give that opportunity to as many people as possible.
I'm quoting again from your book here, but you're also quoting from Derek Bach, a Harvard president, wrote Universities in the Marketplace, and he wrote, faculties currently display scant interest in preparing undergraduates to be democratic citizens, a task once regarded as the principal purpose of a liberal education and one urgently needed at this moment in the United States. He wrote that almost a decade ago. But the idea of perhaps undergraduates as a kind of an afterthought at a number of colleges and universities.
Well, I'm afraid so, and this goes to the distinction between university and college that I was trying to make earlier. Faculty are trained to become specialists, and they're committed to their particular research discipline, and there's a great hazard that when you walk into the room with 18- and 19-year-olds, you think of them as, you know, future versions of yourself. Hmm. The fact of the matter is, when I teach my course in American literature, I know, and I'm perfectly comfortable with the fact, that a very tiny minority, if any, of those students aspires to go on to become professor of American literature. I'm in there because I'm trying to give them a sense of our past, of looking at the past through the eyes of some of the most intelligent, creative, sensitive observers we've ever had in this country, who wrote down their impressions of what it meant to be an American. And I don't care whether they're going to go on to public life or finance, or they're going to be stay-at-home moms or dads. I'm in there to give them a sense of what kind of a society they're living in and what have been the contentions and struggles that America has gone through over the centuries, and that it will continue to go through. Now, this sounds a little self-serving, but seems to me that's the right reason to walk into the class and teach, not to try to produce simulacra of yourself.
You are a tenured professor at a very elite university in New York, and I'm also thinking, as you're describing, the number of itinerant professors that we have in this country,
yes,
teaching assistants, many of them cobbling together a barely subsistence living, you know, teaching a course here and there, largely,
yes,
to undergraduates.
Yes. Well, this is a very important point, and as I said earlier, to get to broaden the conversation, I mean, the public image of the college professor is often, you know, a coddled, overpaid person who spends a few scant hours in the classroom and the rest of the time travels around to conferences and maybe writes papers that nobody else is interested in reading. There are some examples of that, but the reality is that in the last quarter century or so, most faculty in this country have been struggling more and more to put together a living, often with multiple jobs at different campuses, without benefits in many cases, without job security. And this is a very dangerous trend for the future of the profession. Now, mm-hmm, it's connected to the problem that I'm sure is on the mind of many of your listeners, and that is the cost of college. One way in which we have been trying as a society to address the cost of college is to cut where we can, and one place you can cut is in the salaries and remuneration of faculty. I think that's not a very good place to cut, because the faculty at the end of the day, with all their imperfections, really are the future. It's ultimately, a college is only as good as the teacher who walks in, closes the door, and gives the students an experience in the classroom.
There's not a simple answer to this question, but what do you think is driving the high cost of higher education? Now, it varies. Obviously, if it's a state university, it's going to be different from a private college. But what are the cost drivers?
Well, it is a very complicated question, and there are many answers. But we want to keep in mind a few points that I think often get lost in this discussion. Private colleges, except for for-profit private colleges, which is the fastest-growing sector of higher education, private colleges, they set their price lower than their cost, okay? That is, even if you are a well-to-do family and you're paying so-called full freight for your child at a place like Penn or Princeton or Swarthmore or some other very distinguished private institution, you are not paying the full cost of what your child is getting from that institution. If you think of all the counseling services, physical fitness, career advising, the fraction of the faculty time that your child gets, all those support services cost more than what you're paying. So every student in every private nonprofit college in the United States is subsidized to some extent. So when we say that it costs too much, what we're really saying is we want that subsidy to be even larger. And that presents a very significant challenge to these institutions because they have a lot of expenses. Outfitting the labs, if you're a research university, outfitting the labs for your science faculty so that they can conduct important scientific work is extraordinarily expensive. I think a wasteful area of expenditure is in college athletics, where most of the money that gets plowed into college athletics, that is, you know, varsity athletics, competitive athletics, I'm not talking about physical fitness centers inside the institution. Most of that money goes right back into the athletic program and does not really help to subsidize the rest of what the institution is doing. But if you step back and look at the broader picture, the most significant reason for the rapidly rising cost of tuition and the rapidly rising level of student debt in this country is the decline of public investment. Hmm. That is, our state institutions, from the community colleges, which are extremely important to our future, though the gateways for the children of immigrants in many cases, from the community colleges all the way up to the great flagship state universities like the University of Virginia, which has been in the news recently, or North Carolina or Michigan or whatever, all of those institutions are getting less funding from their states. Now, I'm not in the business of demonizing governors and state legislators. They have a lot of bills to pay. And especially following the recession, the tax revenue is not there to meet those bills. But the fact is, we must find a way to turn this trend around. The reason that the United States, well, one reason that the United States became such a significant nation in the 20th century is that we provided higher education for a greater portion of our citizenry than any society in history. And we did that by making huge investments. In California, for example, where you had community colleges, state colleges, and great research universities like Berkeley and UCLA, this was the envy of the world. And you now have almost 500,000 students, would-be students in the state of California, who can't get into the courses they want to take at the community colleges in their own state. So we have a very big problem in this country, and we need to confront it.
And that's Andrew DelBanco, professor of American Studies and Humanities at Columbia University, author of a new and timely book called College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. And we have calls coming in to 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Thomas from East Hampton to join us. And Thomas, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. This
morning.
Is a great conversation.
Thank you.
Little background on myself. I worked in financial aid for 27 years, and I've seen the escalation in the of this focus on research from the research institution, as the speaker was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And also now working in the urban school district. I retired about 2 years ago, kind of scared of what happened here in New Jersey with Governor Christie and my retirees. So I said, let me get out. And I started a couple businesses trying to help communities do better as far as parent involvement in education. But what I'm seeing is this lack of balance between the notion of apprenticeship, where you prepare students for good-paying jobs. One example would be, I had a friend who works in an urban school, and the student had graduated, wasn't going to college, but said he wanted to do work at Best Buy. Well, the student went to take a test at Best Buy. The test required a certain level of computer knowledge that the student didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't even answer the questions for a simple customer service job at Best Buy. So my concern right now is, like, if you don't go to college, where's the balance between preparing students and the public, or well, kids primarily, for just basic good-paying jobs if college isn't, you know, affordable, or that's not something that they would be able to do. That's my concern.
I hear your concern. I hear your question. Thomas, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Andrew DelBanco, any thoughts?
Well, a lot of different answers. It's a great question. Some people will say, this is the job of our high schools, and they're not doing it. And I think there's some truth to that, that K through 12 education is in that's a whole other program, right?
Right.
K through 12 education is in tough shape in this country and should be doing a better job. Others will say that we're stuck with an old-fashioned idea of what a college is, and that the brave new world that's coming is going to be online education. And that the young person that the caller was referring to is going to get those computer skills by logging on to a relatively inexpensive online course, get a certificate or a credential that says he passed that, or more importantly, get the skill that he needs to pass that job test. There's probably some truth to both of those statements and prognostications. The fact is that we're living in a more and more sophisticated world. We speak of the global knowledge economy. That young person at the end of the day is competing not just against other young people in his or her neighborhood, but against people in Mumbai and Stockholm and Beijing, because more and more work is going to be sort of distance work. So we have to make sure that our post-secondary education provides those skills at the same time, in my view, as it continues to provide the traditional function of college, which is the other themes we've been talking about, preparation for democratic citizenship.
Do you think colleges and universities should be providing remedial courses for their students with the idea that they need help to get up to speed on this college-level coursework?
I think they should, and many of them, of course, are. Naturally, it's unfair and unproductive to admit a totally unprepared student to a highly competitive college in order to be generous to that student. That's not good for either the institution or the student. But much of the time, the gap between what the student has coming in and what he or she may need to have a successful college career is not that great. And I think colleges have to recognize that they're dealing with a new kind of student constituency. I think they also have to make a larger commitment to supporting the K-12 schools by training teachers, by supporting their community in a variety of ways. I think colleges have to recognize their responsibility to the community, and the ivory tower has to come down, and the walls have to become more open.
Thinking about that student that might have attended Harvard, let's say, 200 years ago, and the student who is attending a college or university today, while they might be 18 years old, chances are they're female, chances are they're a minority, and perhaps more worldly than that young student entering Harvard for the first time, again, 200 years ago.
Well, that's certainly true, and that's as it should be. I mean, we've never been a static society. America has always been forward-looking, and the challenge of any institution, whether it's a corporation in the for-profit sector or an educational institution in the nonprofit sector, is to adapt to the times and recognize the changing realities of whom we're serving. The point of my book, if I could boil it down, is that I think we're at a moment where the traditional college is under tremendous pressure. It's going to change. And my concern is that as we move into the future, let's not totally forget what the fundamental mission, what the core mission has been for several centuries, and let's find some way to retain some fidelity to that mission. That's a tall order, but I think we have to meet it.
And the mission is, I mean, broadly speaking, and again, we're almost up on a break here, is to think about how people can contribute to our democracy.
I think that's a very important part of it, and it's one that we hear almost nothing about. I mean, politicians in both parties, they have different roadmaps on how to get there. But when they talk about the importance of higher education, it's almost exclusively in terms of preparing for the marketplace. Mm. And that's fine, and that's important, and it's understandable that that's what the emphasis is. But I think we need to remember that these institutions have been key to our society in another way. And the final point I like to make about college, which is the hardest to make without sounding all mushy-minded and sentimental, is that, you know, I'd like to tell a story that...
Well, you know what? If you don't mind, only because I'm tied to the clock here. Let's take a short break, and then we'll hear your story
after the short break.
And that's Andrew Del Banco, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Nearly 250,000 cases of prostate cancer will be diagnosed in the U.S. this year. African American men and men with a family history of prostate cancer are at increased risk. Fox Chase offers a prostate cancer risk assessment service to help you make informed decisions about risk and prevention. It all begins with a detailed analysis of family medical history. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of the Temple University Health System.
The cancer at the heart of our democracy is the political party system, according to Mickey Edwards. He says party leaders have too much control over who runs for office, what bills make it to the floor, and how lawmakers vote. Edwards is a former Republican congressman. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his new book, The Parties Versus the People. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We visit an African-American church in Charlotte where the pastor says he supports Barack Obama, even though he doesn't agree with the president's recent support of gay marriage. Also, as Michelle Obama gets set to take the stage at the DNC, we'll look at her tenure as First Lady. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Andrew DelBanco about why a good college education is good for our democracy. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You had a story to tell. Go ahead.
I'll keep it very quick.
No problem.
I went to speak to an alumni group from my own university, and I spoke about what we've been talking about, the importance of college for training people in the market and the importance of college for developing democratic citizens. And then an elderly alumnus stood up and said, Professor, a very characteristic New Yorker, said, Professor, thanks for coming down and talking to us. Very nice. You made some decent points, but I think you missed the main point. So I took a deep breath and said, okay. Please, what's the main point that I missed? And he said something I'll never forget. He said, college taught me to enjoy life. And what he meant by that was it had opened his mind and his spirit and even his heart to literature, to an understanding of the contentious ideas that people have fought over on how to run a just society. To music and art, which we require all our students to study at Columbia, so that he came out with a broader sense of the world and of experience than he had had when he went in. And I thought, you know, that was the best explanation for why college matters that I had ever heard.
The pursuit of happiness.
Exactly, exactly. And that doesn't mean, and Senator Santorum is right about that, that doesn't mean, of course, that if you don't go to college, you're doomed to be an undeveloped person. There are many wonderful people I know with great gifts who, for one reason or another, didn't go or didn't finish college. But college is a place that helps people find their road to happiness when it works well.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Alex from Temple University joining us on Radio Times. Alex, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to speak about the general education requirements that a lot of colleges have, and about, you know, how much they should be used as a guiding force or for incoming students to, you know, expose them to things which they otherwise might not be exposed to, mm-hmm. and how much it becomes a hindrance to keeping students in school for longer. Especially if they've taken a more like hands-on approach to their education. This is particularly relevant to my case because I'm stuck super senior at Temple with 139 credits with almost three majors, and I'm still stuck in some basic science and technology gen ed courses because my social science credits don't count.
Well, interesting comment, and I think, Alex, I understand what you're saying, which is that most kids are in at a university for a job and have to sometimes take these I guess, literature courses, and not all of them work out. Go ahead, Andrew DelBanco.
Well, it's a fair point, and every institution has its own culture and its own system of counting credits and requirements, or some don't have any requirements at all. Mm. But, you know, I have to say the institutions that I'm most impressed by, or where my heart seems to lie, are places like, again, in your area, Ursinus College, which requires all its incoming students to take a seminar. I think they call it the Common Intellectual Experience Seminar, in which they read a relatively small number of the great books of the Western tradition that compel them to confront big questions about the meaning of life, the responsibility one has to one's children, and or to, if you're a child, to your parents, or what's honorable and dishonorable behavior when you're in a battlefield situation, which is what so many of the great poems and novels have been about. Mm. And I think my sense is that the students have a tremendously valuable experience. These are books that they would never read voluntarily. I mean, one of the things we are a little reluctant to say to young people is, you know, we're older than you are. We've had a little more experience. You got to trust me, and I'm going to tell you that you need to read this and give it a chance, because otherwise they're not going to read it, or they're not going to learn how to listen to a Beethoven symphony. The other thing I like about that kind of program, I was up at Bard College in upstate New York yesterday, and they have something very similar, is that all the students read the same books, not for very long or for much of their college career, but at the outset, which gives them something to talk about, gives them something in common, regardless of what their backgrounds may be. So I'm a big fan of that kind of core curriculum education, and I'd like to see more of it.
I'm interested in the way you frame that, which is that perhaps universities or even professors are reluctant to say to their students, I know more than you. I'm gonna set the agenda here.
Yeah, well, you know what? The scientists are not afraid to say it. The scientists say, look, if you don't pass Physics 1, you can't take Physics 2.
Exactly.
You know, if you don't pass Chem 1, you can't take Orgo. They know that knowledge is cumulative in their area of knowledge, and they're not bashful about saying it. I think they have the opposite problem, actually. Many colleges discourage students from developing an interest in science because they set the bar so high, and you get one bad grade and you get sort of chucked out of the program. Mm. But I do think that in the broader humanistic area, we've gotten very bashful about asserting things to our students. And colleges, like everything else in our country, are now part of the consumer culture, where we think of students as customers. We want them to be happy. We want to please them. I mean, I want my students to be happy, too. But sometimes that means they have to go through some hard work and experience some disappointments and maybe even get some bad grades. That's getting harder and harder to do in our era of student evaluations when, you know, a young professor might not get promoted if too many students say, you know, this guy is really tough on me. I didn't enjoy his class.
Because they get a bad write-up from the students, right?
Right. Now, in my own experience, the best teachers I had in college were the ones I disliked the most. And only later did I realize how much I had learned from them.
And how do your students feel about you?
Well, you know, I never read the online student evaluations, but I'm happy to say I have a big enrollment this fall in my course on American literature, so I guess they think it's okay.
Let me see what Wade from Northeast Philadelphia has to say. Wade, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I'm a proud alumnus of the University of Maryland in College Park, long time ago. I'm grateful for everything about my college experience, and I'm grateful that I had a curriculum for my major that allowed a certain amount of opportunity to take elective courses, which I think really well-rounded my whole college experience with a number of other things. And afterwards, I got a Bachelor of Science, did get a job that working for the state of Maryland that degree qualified me for, but at a certain point understood that it really wasn't what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, and I'm now run and own a business, and I don't know anything about running a business, but I really think it helped me support that creative aspect of myself that allowed my mind to kind of wander and figure things out as how to make my business successful. And, you know, so I just wanted to throw that out
there.
Well,
I'm glad you did.
And kind of supportive of what your guest is saying, that there are things in it, and it took me to about 40 years old to kind of figure all that out. And so I think there's great value in that. I think maybe it kept me from maybe getting stuck in a certain profession, per se, and then at 40, 45, figuring out that I really don't like it and was kind of stuck and to figure out what to do next.
Well, wait, I just have to ask you a very quick question. Now, because there's a lot of noise in the background. Is that your business that we're hearing?
Yes, it is. There's a Staples stapling away. We manufacture cat furniture, things for cats to climb on and scratch on.
Oh, that's great.
It was born out of a hobby, and I figured
and
it out.
There you go.
You know?
Oh, I appreciate the call. I just had to know what was going on behind you there.
Yeah.
Andrew, I'd be curious what you have to say to Wade's
well,
story.
Well, it's a great comment, and it provokes a couple of thoughts. And I got a wonderful email a couple of weeks ago from somebody who read my book, I guess, and said, you know, he majored in history. His friends were all doing business. And then when he got out of college, he had no idea what he could do. He somehow or other stumbled into a job at a raceway. Hmm. I don't know whether it was a horse raceway or a NASCAR raceway. And he said, you know, he was terrified. He didn't know much about finance and didn't know how to run a business. But that he discovered that what he had learned by studying history and reading carefully and critically and is that he knew how to think. And he knew how to confront problems that he hadn't seen before and how to get his hands around them. And he's had a very successful career, and the business is thriving. Now, you know, not every story comes out as happily as that one. But the point, this goes to my it's not an either-or right. problem. In the liberal arts, you learn to read critically, to analyze problems, to write clearly. Those are skills which, as far as I know, every kind of work in this country values. And employers are often complaining that their new employees don't have those skills. So there's something to be said for the liberal arts. The other thing, very quickly, is that it's clear that the old pattern of you get a job in your 20s and that's your job for life. That's becoming a rarity. Most young Americans are going to have multiple jobs in their lives, and they're going to move from field to field, and they're going to be working in areas that don't even exist yet with the rapid change in technology. So I think fundamentally the ability to think and explore and to learn about new problems is ultimately much more important than any specific skill that you could acquire en route to your college degree.
Wade, thanks for the call to Radio Times to see what Ed from Warrington has to say. Ed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I have a sort of a complaint. I think in America, anyone without a college degree is looked at somewhat askance, somewhat like, lacking in certain skills. Even I heard you say it a little while ago. You said, I know people without a college degree, and they're mm-hmm. somewhat talented. And I go with one of my favorite things I ever read was in Germany, they have two respected paths. You either go to college or you become a technical person. And whereas I think in America, if you don't have a college degree, you're not employable.
Well, Ed, I appreciate the call, and I think you raise an important point, and I want to give Andrew Del Banco a chance to respond to that. What do you think?
Well, the caller has a point, and this was Senator Santorum's point, though. Again, he used it for pretty raw political purposes. I don't think I said somewhat creative or somewhat valuable. I said I know some really talented, smart people who didn't go to college. And in fact, out in California, I understand, in the Silicon Valley, it's becoming almost chic to drop out of college. You know, when you go and you apply for working in some new entrepreneurial startup, it's kind of cool to say, well, I was beyond college. I didn't need it anymore, and I left early. So I think that actually the sine qua non of the college degree is getting a little shaky. But at the same time, and the caller makes a fair point about mm-hmm. Germany, we've always been resistant in this country to a tracking system. That is, to telling young people at an early age, look, you're not suited for this, you're suited for that. It's true that we put people in a position where they take a lot of responsibility onto themselves by our not telling them that. But I don't think we want to become a society that tells 12 and 14 and even 15-year-olds, you're not fit for this. You don't need to read any books, and, you know, you just couldn't appreciate it, and you don't have the kind of mind that's up to that. My sense is that most of the time one is wrong when one says that to a young person.
Let me get Aaron from Orland to join us. Aaron, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello.
Hi there. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for the professor regarding the influence of private money in colleges and universities. I recently saw something about how much money the Koch brothers have given to many, many colleges and universities with strings attached, and I'm wondering, how is that affecting the way professors teach? Thank you.
Aaron, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Andrew Del Banco, go ahead.
Well, most institutions that I know anything about are very, very leery about strings attached to donations. Sometimes it can be tempting to allow it if there's a new program you want to start up and a donor has a particular passion. But, of course, the caller speaks of private money. All of our institutions are a hybrid of public and private. And the great universities and colleges have thrived to the extent they have because of the generosity of their alumni donors. So there's a narrow path we have to walk down. The donor has a right to want their gift to be used for purposes that they believe in, but the donor should not have a right in an environment of academic freedom to stipulate what the professor who's holding the chair that donor might have given, or the department that donor has underwritten, not to direct what's allowed to be thought by that professor or by that department. So it's a fine line. I think the greater concern actually is in the funding from pharmaceutical companies and others, where more and more of the research that's being done in our research universities is designed to end up with a profitable invention or therapy or drug. Sometimes the results can be very good, but you don't want to close out the freewheeling exploratory researcher who says, I'm interested in this problem and I have no idea where it's going to lead. Often, that's the kind of research that leads to the most extraordinary discoveries, and we don't want to close that off.
Aaron, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're nearly out of time here, Andrew Del Banco, but you talk about young people thinking about having multiple careers. Wouldn't you say whether it's a career or not, we should always be thinking of lifelong learning in this very competitive, fast-moving world?
Absolutely. And one thing that's been a little missing from our conversation, my fault, is that we don't want to forget that the college population is changing very radically in this country. More and more college students are what we call non-traditional students, older people coming back to college after a career, after service in the Army. And lifelong learning is what it's all about.
Well, Andrew Del Banco, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Author of a book called College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Jonathan Best helping us out today. And Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.